I warn you, my presentation is R-rated. There's going to be some violence and some bad language. No sex, but violence and bad language. The World Bank reports that there were no financial crises between 1948 and 1970. And they report there were 117 since then. The remarkable thing is that after seeing Mexico and Russia and the Asian crisis, long-term capital management, U.S. savings and loans, they were still sort of stunned and shocked by the fact that it happened. Where's the first? And so, what happened? I'm going to try in 15 minutes, and after the clarity of the historian, the obtuseness of the economist, I'm going to throw lots of slides up and try to explain this. Second one. Well, the first thing to be said, as Henry suggested, is if you look from 19, and we could go back further, if you look from 1960 down to around 1980, you can see a dramatic decline in the rate of profit. What matters to capitalists more than anything else is profitability. And the question is, what did they do about that? And I think an explanation of where we are right now requires an explanation of this movement. Forget Europe, we're talking about the United States. By the way, that's what I'm going to talk about today, the United States, because it is ground zero. Well, one of the things they did about that rate of profit, one of the first things they thought about doing was how to attack the working class. Alan Budd, professor of economics at the London Business School and chief economic advisor to Margaret Thatcher, in astonishingly candid terms, said what occurred during the 1980s, conservative monetary and fiscal policy was seen by Thatcher government as a very good way to raise unemployment. Raising unemployment was an extremely desirable way of reducing the strength of the working class. What was engineered in Marxist terms, this is his language, not mine, this is Thatcher's chief economic advisor, was a crisis of capitalism which was recreated the reserve army of labor and has allowed capitalists to make high profits ever since. If you can flip the next one. The results of that, if you look at the wages from 1960 to around 1973, 75, they're growing. After that, for 30 years, they've declined. Real wages in the United States have declined for over 30 years. They've still not restored their level that they were 30 years ago. On the other hand, productivity continues to grow. What Alan Budd would be suggesting, not me of course, is that there's been a dramatic increase in the rate of exploitation. And how do they do that? Monetary and fiscal policy, free trade agreements, and a number of other policies that they used. But the effect is not simply to raise the rate of exploitation, to increase the output produced by labor, and labor gets a smaller and smaller share of it. They've done something else. In 76, the richest 10% had 50% of all wealth. In 2001, they have 70% of all wealth. What did they do? How did they manage to accomplish that? And here I turn to Alan Budd's favorite economist, apparently. To the possessor of money capital, the process of production appears merely as an unavoidable intermediate link, as a necessary evil for the sake of money making. All nations with a capitalist mode of production are therefore seized periodically by a feverish attempt to make money without the intervention of the process of production. All of a sudden, the New York Times and a bunch of others are sort of turning back to Marx and asking questions. Was he right? He only lost the vote 52-48 in one of their polls, which is astonishing. Wait 2 weeks. Stock market goes down, watch Marx go up. Switch. This is part of the explanation for what's happening today, and it's the language is used, financialization, and I'll talk more about that along the way. And what this is simply a graph that tells you what share of profits now goes to the financial sector as opposed to the productive sector. So this is a change inside the capitalist class. More and more of what's going on in economic activity is now in the financial sector as opposed to in the productive sector. The effects, of course, are here we see consumption growing, overall household net worth and consumption rising together. And of course, it's the famous American increase in consumption that allows the Chinese to export their goods. But the most remarkable thing down here, which we can't see all that well, is almost all the increase in consumption has been accomplished by the top 20%. Everyone else is flat. The top 20%, and this partly has to do with what's happened with the rise in their stocks, or what was their rise in their stocks. What's happened with some of the ways in which they've gamed the system other than the rate of exploitation, which I'm about to get to, is if you look at 1929, top 1% had this much of the wealth in the country, and this stops in about 1998, you can see they're climbing back up again. And so part of what they did is increase productivity faster than wages, basically attack the working class, but they've done something else as well. And that's profit exploitation from exchange. The crisis has revealed the extent to which contemporary finance relies on drawing profits from the personal income of working people and others across society. Between 73 and 2000, the average income of the bottom 90% of American taxpayers fell by 7%. Incomes of the top 1% rose by 148.1, 343, and the extremely well-off 0.01 rose by an amazing 599%. And so from the traumatized worker to the traumatized consumer, or I owe my soul to the company store. Anyone remember that song? Sorry. I'll start singing if you don't. Since the late 1970s, real accumulation has witnessed mediocre and precarious growth. So on the productive side, they've had some improvement, but not enough. Finance has grown extraordinarily in terms of employment, profit, size of institutions and markets. There's been deregulation, technological and institutional change, innovation and global expansion. While real accumulation is performing below historical expectations, the capitalist class has found new sources of profits through the revamped mechanisms of finance. Credit card debt, home mortgage debt, oil price speculation, food price speculation. These are all using the sphere of exchange to lower the real wage and gain a larger share of surplus. Please, Chris. Just one example is you can see what's happened with mortgage debt. Home mortgage debt as a percentage of after-tax personal income, you can see from 2000 to 2006 what's happened. I got 15 minutes, I'm gonna keep speeding through this. The whole idea that somehow or other the problem is there's no confidence, if we could just restore confidence to the system. Well, there should be no confidence in the system. They should be very anxious about what's going on. Why? Financial assets are paper claims on future wealth. 1950s to 1970s, they were worth 400% of GDP in the so-called golden age before the exploitation got higher. In 2007, the paper claims were worth 1,000% of GDP. U.S. credit market debt was 168% of GDP in 81. It's 350% in 2007. Profits generated in the financial sector grew from 10% in the early 80s to 40% in the present period. Not real production, but ultimately and critically dependent on real production. The problem is not confidence. There's a good reason for lack of confidence. It is not psychological, but objective. Creating fragility. As the gap between paper claims and the real economy grows, the system becomes more fragile. 2000 to 2005, after-tax income rose just 34.7%, barely one-third of the increase in home prices. This is precisely why the real estate bubble proved to be a bubble. A rise in asset prices or expansion of credit is never excessive in itself. It is excessive only in relation to the underlying flow of value. Debt obligations depend on everyone being able to pay. When one can't, the chain is broken. Housing prices rise in relation to income, you create a fragile system. Stock prices rise in respect to the profitability of the firm, you wind up creating fragility. Can't help myself, being a left-wing economist and being on the market for so long, I need vengeance. And is there a better, except of course for the absolute havoc that's gonna be created out there, one that finds it hard to resist. This will be a bit arcane, but deregulation of finance. This was encouraged by audacious claims that mathematical economic models map reality and priced uncertainty, making old-fashioned precautions redundant, precautions like regulation. There is a new financial architecture to represent the basic institutions and practice of today's lightly regulated financial system. The celebratory narrative associated with the NFA states that relatively free financial markets minimize the possibility of financial crisis and the need for government bailouts. Nothing was gonna happen, don't worry about it, forget Asia, forget Mexico, forget all the other crises. We have a mathematical model. In fact, we won Nobel Prizes for this. This theoretical cornerstone of the NFA is based on patently unrealistic assumptions and has no convincing empirical support. Thus, the scientific foundation of the new financial architecture is shockingly weak, and its celebratory narrative is a fairy tale. This is just the bankruptcies of the savings and loans of the United States of the late 80s. We haven't got a graph yet of what's happening now. There'd be no room here. we need to change the scale of this to have room, and of course we don't know what the end of this is going to be because it's growing dramatically. It's just a sign and symptom of how fragile the system is. Not yet. I'm going to finish up with a sort of brief talk about politics here. There seems to be no resistance to this up till now. Certainly state capitalism is coming. But state capitalism for whom? At this point, it doesn't seem to be anything like, even if Obama gets elected, which is seems to be a real possibility in the United States, there's no labor movement behind him like there was Roosevelt in the 1930s, which made demands. And so this state capitalism that's going to come out of this crisis, the question becomes, what's it going to look like? Well, in Wall Street, 1929, bankers apparently jumped out of buildings. That's the story anyway. And I think we have to think a better world is possible.